Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. We also welcome our radio and internet audiences, and we welcome everybody to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. My name is Dr. Patrick O'Reilly. I'm chair of the Commonwealth Club Psychology Forum, and I'm genuinely delighted to introduce today's speaker, Professor Fred Cruz. Dr. Cruz is professor emeritus of English at the University of California, Berkeley, where he taught for 36 years and won a Distinguished Teaching Award. He's the author, co-author, or editor of 21 books, one of which was a New York Times bestseller, and two of which were finalists for a National Book Award. Most recently, he is the author of the 746-page biography, Freud, The Making of an Illusion, about which he will speak tonight. So please welcome Dr. Cruz.
Thanks for coming. I was going to pass around a copy of my book, but I see that you can find it right out there, so I won't do that. In the Chronicle yesterday, this talk was announced with a different title. It was supposed to be the title of the book, but it said, Freud, The Making of an Illusionist. And yeah, I thought about it for a few minutes, and I said, not bad. Freud, as we'll see, had a lot in common with stage magicians whose primary activity, as you know, is misdirection, calling attention to that which is not. And I think you'll see that in some respects Freud belonged very much in this tradition with his rhetoric, because every challenging question that you might pose to Freud is evaded, not answered, but evaded in his works in a manner that can be quite brilliant at times. So, an illusionist. I want to talk about Freud's reputation and how it grew after World War II, and what's the matter with the version of Freud that came out in those years. And then I hope to talk more about some of the substance of my book, which has to do with what kind of person Freud was, how he changed, and what kind of vicissitudes he ran into as a result of premature generalization, because his colleagues in his lifetime were much, much more skeptical toward him than most people have been in the 20th century, in the later 20th century. Freud died in 1939, just as World War II was breaking out. And at the end of the war, his movement was very much reconstituted westward. Actually, that was a process that had begun when Hitler came to power in 1933. The center of gravity of psychoanalysis, which had been Vienna, Budapest, Berlin, moved to London and New York, basically, and Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles, but really a big shift toward the English language. Freud's heir in every respect was, of course, Anna Freud. She was the custodian of the movement. She was the custodian of his reputation. And in the later 1940s, after the war had ended, she saw to it that Freud's reputation would be expanded, would be glorified. When he died, he was very, very famous as a writer. He was very, very much adored by the international educated public. But his colleagues in psychology still entertained doubts about him. In the 1950s, his reputation absolutely soared, and this was a result of very self-conscious manipulations by his successors, and Anna Freud in particular. One thing that was done, and it was something admirable, is the creation of a complete psychological writings in the English language, under the general editorship of James Strachey, who was very much in the inner circle of these people, a book that went on from 1953 to 1974, ending in 24 volumes. It's in many ways a magnificent piece of scholarship. There are some things wrong with it. But at the same time, the editorial apparatus of that book contains a good deal of propaganda that you wouldn't ordinarily notice, but it's there. And this was done in coordination with Anna Freud. A great crisis faced the movement in the later 40s when it appeared that Freud's letters to his best friend through the 1890s, Wilhelm Fliess, had survived the war in a very dramatic fashion, which I won't go into, but they were there. The Princess Marie Bonaparte, who was a Freudian, was the principal person who saved these letters. Freud knew of their existence before his death and wanted them to be destroyed. As for Fliess's letters to him, he did destroy them. He claimed that he couldn't find them, but of course he destroyed them. Why is this important, and how does this relate to Freud's reputation? Wilhelm Fliess was a general physician in Berlin. People say he was an ear, nose, and throat person. He wasn't. He was just a general physician. But a man with great intellectual ambition. He did do a lot of surgery on the nose, and in one particular case, which has now, since 1985 or 1984, become very famous, the case of Emma Eckstein, we know that his nasal operations had a rather scandalous relationship to his friendship with Freud, something we could go into. Some of you know all about it anyway. Fliess was a theoretician who believed in something called the nasal reflex neurosis, which was a theory that diseases or disorders in one part of the body were actually reflections of something awry in another part of the body. And in particular, stomach problems and problems with the genitals, he regarded as emanating from improprieties in the nose. And as a result, he prescribed a kind of ladder of measures for correction of these problems, starting with the application of cocaine to the nose. And if that didn't work, then there would be a cauterization of the element of the nose which was producing the stomach aches and the dysmenorrhea and so on. And if that didn't work, surgery was called for, the removal of a bone in the nose. And Freud believed all this stuff and, in fact, was an active advocate of Fliess's theory. But Fliess was also a biological speculator who believed that all human beings are bisexual and that it's constitutionally, not in their behavior, and that men as well as women have menstrual cycles. The male cycle is 23 days, the female is 28. And he believed that by forming equations connecting these two numbers in various ways, he could predict all kinds of things right up to and including the day of the death of the person. In other words, this stuff was completely nuts. And Freud absolutely believed it. Freud and Fliess first became acquainted in 1897, but they became best friends in 1892, and they remained best friends until the end of the century when they had a violent fight over priority because Fliess perceived that Freud was planning to plagiarize his idea of bisexuality. Freud's relationship to Fliess was totally dependent. He worshipped Fliess. In fact, spoiler alert, he was in love with him. There's a good deal of bisexual innuendo in the biography of Sigmund Freud, and we could have a whole lecture about that. Well, this was a problem. This was a terrible problem for the Freud establishment after his death, because Fliess was a screwball, and Freud, regarded as the greatest thinker of modern times, was totally dependent upon him intellectually. And this went through the years of the formation of psychoanalytic doctrine. And Frank Soloway, who's in Berkeley now, he was at Harvard at the time, wrote a great book in 1979 called Freud, Biologist of the Mind, which is all about the relation, not all about, but largely about the relationship between Freud's ideas and Fliess's ideas. Freud continually borrowed from Fliess. Well, this was a great embarrassment. And now these letters were going to come out. What should Anna Freud and the others do about these letters? The answer is that they made up a story that Freud's relationship to Fleece was entirely encapsulated within a neurosis of on Freud's part, that he was going through a crisis, and his love of Fleece, although they wouldn't call it love, and the book was Baudelaireized in ways to indicate that there's no sexual. Whoa, dear, dear, I've just been judged faulty. Yeah. Fleece was represented in the editorial apparatus of these letters as being much crazier than he actually was, because a lot of people listened respectfully to some of Fleece's ideas. As for Freud, the relationship to Fleece was folded into his so-called self-analysis. Now, the self-analysis is something very mysterious that Freud alludes to a few times in his letters to Fleece, hardly ever mentions it in his own writings, and it's really a very abortive kind of a process whereby Freud attempted, through introspection, to find out what had made him as neurotic as he was. Because Freud was very aware that he was a nervous man, that he suffered from depression, that he suffered from guilty thoughts, whose origin he tried to divine. And so his self-analysis was his attempt to understand what had gone wrong in his own case. Well, in the Freud-Fleece letters, as they were published in German in 1950 and in English in 1954, the explanation of Freud's problems with Fleece turned out to be a great celebration. Freud overcame his dependency upon Fleece through self-analysis. That was the thesis of the introduction to this book by Ernst Kriss. And so it turns out that the creation of psychoanalysis, according to this book, was a tremendous breakthrough of introspection by one man. Now, interestingly, Freud himself hadn't taken this line at all in his autobiographical writings. He wrote a history of the psychoanalytic movement, very brief, in 1914. He wrote an autobiographical study in 1925, which also constitutes a kind of birth myth for psychoanalysis. And in these works, Freud claimed that he had been a plodder who had simply listened to his patients. And his patients had told him things that were actually false, but he gradually realized that those statements that the patients had made, though false, were a kind of unconscious psychological cover for what was really bothering them. And this was the Oedipus complex. To put it all very briefly, he went from thinking that his hysterical patients had gotten hysterical through sexual molestation and the repression of memories of having been molested in childhood. He went from that to saying, oh no, these people actually wanted to be molested. The females in particular wanted to have sexual intercourse with their fathers, but this caused tremendous guilt, and this guilt caused psychological problems. And by around 1909, Freud believed that the Oedipus complex was the central neurotic manifestation of humankind. But he had arrived at it ploddingly by just being fooled by his patients and then gradually realizing that these many, many women had been disguising something else, something deeper, and that was the operations of the unconscious. So look, we have a contradiction here. On the one hand, we have Freud saying that he really had no imagination at all. He was just being a therapist and was really rather slow to perceive what was the matter with these many, many patients. And on the other hand, we have the view which comes out in the Freud-Fleece letters that he was an intuitive genius who simply arrived all by himself at the Oedipus complex. Now, there's a bit of evidence for the latter allegation because on October 15th, 1897, he wrote to Fleece and said, "I have discovered that I wanted to sleep with my mother and kill my father." That's the origin of the Oedipus complex right there. So what he had said about it earlier, what he'd said about it in his autobiographical reflections, was simply false. Now, which of these two versions is true? Well, obviously, the second one has the authority of autobiographical authenticity to it. But did Freud actually discover anything? At the time of his self-analysis, he was examining his own contemporary dreams. And he believed that whenever he dreamed about his childhood, he was dreaming about something that had actually happened. And so in one dream, he dreams that his nanny in Freiburg, before the family ever moved to Vienna, had molested him. He said, "She was my teacher in sexual matters." And this became something that Freud needed to use as an explanation of his own neuroticism as an adult. He himself had been a victim of sexual molestation. Now, really, you cannot get there from here. You cannot take one of your contemporary dreams and regard it as evidence of something that actually happened when you were a toddler. It just can't be done. So the epistemological basis of the theory is very, very shaky before the theory is ever very well formed. Nevertheless, the Freud-Fleece letters did their job in hyping Freud's reputation instead of destroying it, as the editors feared before they came up with this idea that the self-analysis was the clue to everything. Two other developments were crucial for the reputation of Freud. Number one, the enormous number of primary documents that were in the hands of Anna Freud could have given us a vivid picture of what Freud was actually like, and it would not have very much resembled the official one. What could be done about this? The answer was very ingenious. Anna Freud decided that she would give these letters to the U.S. Library of Congress on the stipulation that nobody would read most of them. Kurt Eisler, who was the original founder of the Freud Archive in the Library of Congress, went to each person who possessed some letters of Freud or other documents and said, "This is wonderful. We're going to save this for posterity, and we're really going to save it because you are going to place a restriction on it so that nobody can read it until such and such a year." And these restrictions went as far as the year 2113. So a lot of this material is still not available. One set of letters of particular interest to me in writing my book was embargoed until the year 2000, which meant that for 50 years, nobody could read these letters. These were the letters between Freud and his fiancée. He was engaged for 4.5 years, from 1882 to 1886. Shortly after they were engaged, his fiancée's mother absconded with her and her sister from Vienna back to Hamburg, where they were originally from. And consequently, Freud couldn't see his fiancée very often. He only saw her 4 more times in the 4 years that remained. And so they wrote to each other constantly. There are almost 1,500 letters between them, and they are absolute dynamite. They completely, not completely, they largely revise our picture of Freud if you read them carefully. At the moment, there's a 5-volume edition coming out bit by bit in Germany, very scholarly edition of these letters. Only 3 volumes have been published so far. When these letters were no longer embargoed, they were still almost impossible for most people to read, including me. And I've had to struggle with German all these years, but Freud's handwriting was a much bigger obstacle than that. But through some intrigue, which I won't go into because the time is just racing by, I got access to typescripts of these letters. They were probably made by Ernest Jones's wife for the other great achievement of the 1950s, which was Ernest Jones's biography of Freud, the classic authorized biography. Jones had known Freud since the early 20th century. He knew him backwards and forwards. He had some skeptical things in his mind about Freud, but this was a book, this 3-volume book, was written with Anna Freud almost literally looking over the shoulder of the author. She vetted every single word of that book. Even so, some fascinating things got inserted that she probably wouldn't approve of, including a good deal of stuff about Freud and the substance, which explains a lot more than I can go into today, namely cocaine. That biography was a tremendous international success, and it influenced me, among others. And in the early 1960s, through most of the 1960s, I was a passionate Freudian. It was largely because of Ernest Jones. The book is very convincing. And yet, it contains the same contradiction that I spoke of earlier. On one page, Freud is a man who is just trying to do his job, just trying to be scientifically ethical about what he's learning from his patients. And he sees that his contemporaries are terribly afraid of this thing called sex. And he's afraid of it too. He's a prude. But he just keeps finding that his patients come up with this topic all the time. And he just gradually realizes that maybe sex has something to do with neurosis. As if the great age of sexology had not been those very years when Freud was inventing psychoanalysis. Croft Ebbing, for example, Havelock Ellis, Albert Mohl, these people revolutionized the study of sex, and Croft Ebbing, by the way, was right there with Freud in the University of Vienna. But Freud in his mythologizing, and then Ernest Jones in his upping the ante of the mythology, presented Freud as the only man of his generation who was willing to face sexuality itself. So on the one hand, that's a version of Freud. But then the fleece version comes into Jones's biography too, because Jones says that through his self-analysis, Freud broke through the repression that had kept humanity in darkness ever since we came down out of the trees. And Freud himself liked to think that the 3 great revolutions in science were those of Copernicus, Darwin, and himself, with himself in the lead, actually, because he was the one who scared people the most. The ego is not master in its own house. It's okay to say, well, the earth is not the center of the cosmos. That's nothing. But to show that people can't control their own unconscious, he said that he had done that. As a result of all these influences, from the 1950s on, for another 15 years or so, Freud absolutely ruled in the English-speaking world. Departments of psychology, departments of psychiatry in the great universities became almost entirely Freudian. And the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders was essentially a Freudian document right up until 1980, when things changed. And now you won't even find the word neurosis in the DSM, much less a Freudian diagnosis. So, if I hadn't miscalculated my time so much, I would have told you about the movement, the scholarly movement, which began in the year 1970, which started to unravel all of this. The great names are Henri Ellenberger, or Ellenberger, as we often say, who wrote a book called The Discovery of the Unconscious, published in that year. It's one of the great works of medical history, or really any kind of history. And what it shows is that psychoanalysis is, at its root, a form of mesmerism or animal magnetism. It goes back, in other words, to the tradition of the 1780s with Anton Mesmer and his hypnotic manipulations combined with a good deal of paranormal theory. And interestingly, Freud himself became quite an aficionado of the paranormal. I mentioned Frank Soloway's book, 1979, absolutely made a revolution in scholarship. The philosopher Frank Chaffee, who died a couple of years ago and was a good friend of mine, in England, began giving talks on the BBC and writing articles with such titles as Was Freud a Liar? 1984, Adolf Grunbaum wrote a study which is not terribly readable, but is very important for showing that the philosophical justifications for the validity of Freudian theory fall apart as soon as you look at them. Peter Swales, an independent scholar, wrote brilliant articles about Freud from 1982 on for the next 20 years or so. And I could go on about this. My own work, once I myself ceased to be a Freudian, was devoted largely to, in a kind of journalistic sense, to promoting or to calling attention to these people's revisionist work on Freud. And that's what I did up until this book. And the book is different because, partly, I made use of all of these letters, these 1,500 letters. And so, if you read the book, you will find extraordinary revelations by Freud himself in his letters to his bride about his nervous difficulties, about his attitude toward her, which is frightening. I mean, don't even mention the Me Too movement. About his overriding ambition, about his self-doubts, because he did not have the kind of self-assurance that Jones and others attributed to him, and perhaps most interestingly of all, about cocaine. And I'm going to say a few things about cocaine, not because I want to reduce psychoanalysis to a drug, but because this drug profoundly changed a young man who began very earnestly wishing to succeed, playing by the established rules of science and medicine. But when he found difficulty in making his way in those normal terms, he became grandiose. He started thinking of himself as already being a great discoverer. And the drug cocaine had a lot to do with this. So let me just say, and last 15 minutes here, it's actually frightening to look at this. I feel like I should make a 3-point shot or something. Ernest Jones had a chapter of his book called The Cocaine Episode. Anna Freud didn't want it to be in there, but he insisted on that because Freud had published a number of papers about cocaine, and these papers weren't going away. Anybody could know that from 1884 to 1887, Freud was the world's leading advocate of the medical applications of cocaine. He found out about cocaine partly from reading a report by a German physician who had discovered that soldiers could march for hours and hours carrying heavy packs and not even get tired or hungry if they'd taken cocaine. But he was most influenced by an American journal called the Detroit Therapeutic Gazette. He had to resort to back numbers of the Gazette because the recent numbers of the Gazette had already backed off a bit from cocaine. But in the back numbers, he found articles by doctors who said that cocaine was a wonderful panacea and that in particular it could be used in the successful withdrawal of morphine addiction. You give cocaine gradually to the patient while the patient is abstaining from morphine. And the cocaine, Freud said, is an antagonist to morphine. And so they two work together very nicely until finally you just have a normal patient with no addiction of any kind. Freud was very impressed by this. What he didn't notice was that the Detroit Therapeutic Gazette was a house organ of the Park Davis Drug Company. It was just like a kind of shopping center throwaway document for all the scientific integrity it might have. But Freud at the time had a friend, a very dear friend, again with a little bit of an erotic connection, who had been his teacher in the University of Vienna, with whom he had also worked in the Physiological Institute for a number of years with Ernst Brucke. The friend had suffered a neuroma. He had suffered an infection from dealing with a corpse. This is Ernst Fleischl von Marxhoff, not to be confused with Fleiss, Fleischl. He had had to have a thumb amputated. Horrible neuromas appeared in his thumb. He took morphine in order to control the pain. He became a morphine addict, and he was absolutely desperate. So Freud, having read the Detroit Therapeutic Gazette, said to Fleischl, "Oh, I can fix that. I'll just give you cocaine, and you're going to get over your morphine." And as he says to his fiancée, Martha, he leapt at it. Like a dying man, his last chance. Well, sure enough, Fleischl took both of these drugs at the same time, and guess what? He became an addict to both of them. And he died in horrible agony 6 years later of his double addiction, suffering from DTs, horrible hallucinations, insects crawling all over his body, and so on. That's one of the stories that I tell in one of my chapters. But when Jones said that the cocaine episode lasted from 1884 to 1887, he was lying. Jones knew how long Freud took cocaine. In a letter, which is now available in the Library of Congress, Jones says to a colleague, "I'm afraid Freud took more cocaine than was good for him, off and on for 15 years. That would place Freud's abstention from cocaine in 1899, after the fundamental tenets of psychoanalysis had been developed. In short, Freud was, quote, on cocaine when he was inventing the great science of psychoanalysis. Now, what do we know about the long-term use of cocaine? Well, for one thing, it encourages grandiosity. People take cocaine and write down the secrets of the universe before they go to bed. And they wake up in the morning and they see that it's absolute crap. There's nothing there, okay? So you can think that you are the savior of the world if you take enough of this stuff or even just take some of it, and it's a temporary effect. It also has sexual implications. Cocaine stimulates sexual fantasy, often of what we would call a perverse kind. That's what Freud's collected works are all about, perverse sexuality. But if you take too much of it, and if you're a male, you're going to suffer impotence. Freud did that too. And then it encourages paranoia. And there are very, very strong indications of a paranoid streak in Freud. Now, to be perfectly honest, some of these indications precede his taking of cocaine. We know exactly when he started taking cocaine. It was April 30th, 1884. But in some of his letters to his fiancée that are shortly before this date, he shows a tendency which is unmistakably paranoid. And I'm thinking here of his dealings with his fiancée's brother, Eli, who had been a good friend of his. But the moment Freud became engaged to Martha Bernays, he decided that Eli was his rival. What? Brother? Rival? What are you talking about? Absolutely. He says, he is now my enemy. And as time went on, he became convinced that Eli had robbed Martha of her nest egg, her money, had stolen it, and he demanded it back. And his letters to his wife, his letters to his fiancée are absolutely hair-raising in their violence and their hatred. And he's just completely out of control. And he says, I'm out of control. That's the way I am. I lose control. This is all very important biographically when you consider that the man allegedly founded a science. What kind of a personality do you need when you found a science? Well, lots of things, of course, inventiveness, imagination, daring, but also prudence and an ability to criticize one's own ideas. Because what does a scientific test do? Does it look for confirmation? No, it looks for disconfirmation. When you have an idea, your obligation as a scientist is to find out what's the matter with it. And to do that, you have to be detached from your own egotism, your own ambition. And what we see in Freud is a personality that was incapable of that kind of mental distance. And we see it over and over again throughout my 700 pages. It's in a way, it's the theme. And let me say one more thing about cocaine. Practically the first thing Freud told the world about cocaine is that it's great for writer's block. Now think about that in relation to his own writing. It's not that Freud took cocaine constantly. He didn't. And by the way, I don't regard him as ever having been a physical addict of cocaine. A physical addict would take more and more, and he would need more and more just to feel decent. Freud took it intermittently, but the occasions on which he took it, well, some of them were sexual. Could talk about that. It was too late. But they were literary. When Freud wanted to write about psychology, he took cocaine. And you can see this very clearly in a document that was never published in his lifetime called Project for Scientific Psychology, which he wrote for the benefit of Fleece. And it's really a fairly crazy piece of work. Some people have respect for it. But Freud himself did not. He kept saying, what did I just say? And I'm throwing this away, and please disregard it. When I wrote it, the keys to knowledge were all available to me. The universe opened up. I understood everything. But God, I can't even read it myself now. This is cocaine. So Freud eventually stopped using cocaine, probably in 1899. We can't be sure. But by that time, he had formed an idea of himself as a revolutionary thinker, as someone who hadn't just discovered all the secrets of the unconscious, but as someone who could overthrow a moral order of which he disapproved because he regarded himself as a victim of it. I haven't said a word about his consciousness of being a Jew, but anti-Semitism was a very strong part of Freud's psychological makeup. And Freud lived in a country with an official religion, Catholicism. And Catholicism, as well as the ordinary prejudice of the man on the street, was holding Freud and people like Freud back. And Freud tremendously resented it. And he conceived of Christianity itself as an oppressive doctrine that enabled people to be hypocrites about how good they were, about how moral they were, about how they were following their best instincts. And part of the meaning of psychoanalysis for Freud was that our real instincts are animal instincts. They are crude. They are aggressive. They are utterly selfish. And the process of civilizing an individual human being is precisely a process of sitting upon this basic human animal nature and taming it at the expense of turning it neurotic. And in his most ambitious thoughts about himself, Freud believed that he was providing the blueprint for a civilization that would not be based on Christian moralism and hypocrisy, but which would allow a certain liberation of instinct to a degree that would enable people to be less neurotic. He was the great prophet of that. And this vision has affected many people. And you could even say there's something, you know, not just grandiose, but grand about it. But the point is that this doctrine takes whatever appearance of validity it might have from Freud's claim of having been able to cure patients of their neuroses. And Freud began making those claims at a time when he had almost no patients at all, because they were all walking out on him because they thought that there was something terribly the matter with him. And if I had time, I could read you passages from the letters to Fleece in which he says, "My office is vacant. I have no patients at all. So I can sit here and write letters to you all day. The patients are gone." This is the exact same period when he begins to make the claim that it was his patients who taught him these eternal truths. So there's an element of not just illusion, but delusion here. And the drug certainly had something to do with it. Now, I want to entertain questions from you.
For all of his motives, dark, nefarious, and neurotic, how fair might it still be to credit him with a major paradigm shift in matters neurological, moving us from brain to mind?
Well, yeah, the question is, wouldn't it be fair to credit Freud with having made a major paradigm shift, moving us from brain to mind? Some such thing actually did happen, but I'm not sure it was such a good thing. Because in the first place, what Freud said about the mind was inaccurate and misled people for a very long time, with results that could be very, very damaging to people who were herded into his style of treatment when they should have been treated in a very different way. So it's all very well to talk about brain versus mind in general, but if Freud had actually discovered anything about the mind, that would make the difference. I don't think he did discover anything about the mind.
The question, does the concept mind precede Freud in some way, making him additionally fraudulent?
Well, I think that the whole tradition of medicine has been a kind of dialogue between brain and mind. Freud returned us to essentially a medieval view of cause and effect in the psychological realm. I'll just briefly give you an example or two. Freud believed that if he could pick up a theme in the utterances of his patient, that this theme had explanatory power for the causation of what was bothering the patient. I'll give you two examples. One of his patients, actually one of his most important patients, but nobody knows her, Anna von Lieben, read the book, suffered from facial sciatica. And so he was talking to her, and she was talking about her relations with her husband, which were not good, and he had insulted her once, And she said, yeah, this insult just felt like a slap in the face. And he said, well, there you are. That's where your sciatica came from. You took this metaphor and you applied it physically, and now you have sciatica. The same patient who weighed about 200 pounds had a problem with her feet, as many overweight people do. She told him at one point that she had made a certain initiative but had realized that it was wrong. It was a false step. He said, well, there you are. That's why your foot hurts. In the Middle Ages, people actually did think in these terms, but they hadn't been thinking that way for a while, and Freud's medical education was based entirely on the idea of getting rid of this kind of pseudoscience. Freud's teachers, who were some of the greatest doctors in the world, and the University of Vienna Medical School was the greatest medical school in the world, they were unanimous in believing that physical manifestations have physical causes and you should look for them before jumping to something else. So when we talk about brain versus mind, it gets very complicated. So, yeah.
Freud's disciples who later split with him, like Jung and Adler, did they recognize these contradictions that you're talking about, or did they fall for the whole line?
It's a very good question. Did the disciples who fell away from Freud, such as Adler and Jung, recognize the intellectual disabilities that I've been talking about? The answer is that they really didn't see that far into Freud, but they had a very strong objection to Freud's manner of dealing with them. And his objection was, that Freud would not tolerate dissent. Freud told his disciples what to believe, and if they didn't believe it, this was heresy. He was essentially a theological figure. He had a doctrine. It was not a science, because in science, when an idea is challenged, the idea about the idea is to test it and find out whether it's true, and if it is not true, you discard it and you continue on with the science. But psychoanalysis was not a science. It was a movement, and it was a business. And a movement and a business have to stay in business. And the way you stay in business is to insist that you're right. And then if someone corners you with an objection that is formidable and worrisome, you either say that that person is crazy, which is what Freud did about all of the disciples who fell away from him. He said they were all paranoid. Or you incorporate the objection into your doctrine and say it was your idea. And that is also what Freud did. And that is a thumbnail history of psychoanalysis.
You might want the microphone.
I'm sorry. Yeah, a couple of things. I took a course in college by Baruch Skinner. And his first opening line was, in 1900s, Freud said God was dead, and now in 1960, I say Freud is dead.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, relating to that, when I was in medical school, we had the lectures in psychiatry, this is the early 1960s, about egos, transference reactants, superegos, etc. And I stood up, which I always put on open mouth, insert 2 feet. I said, this is all, you know, poppycock. There's no experimental scientific basis in fact. And needless to say, I got a terrible grade in psychiatry.
Yeah.
But what I have, the question I have is, how did all this, what I'll call horse and bull manure, hijack a whole field of psychiatry?
Yeah. It's an excellent question, and really I'm just about as puzzled by it as you are, because you would think that the medical profession would have been more skeptical. You really should take a look sometime at a book called The Freud Files by two scholars, because the first half of this book contains excerpts from Freud's contemporaries in criticizing him. They were absolutely brilliant. They saw right through him. There's very little in this world. today that hadn't been said in the 1890s. Freud himself realized that he could not deal with these colleagues successfully, and so he went over their heads. In 1901, with the book called The Psychopathology of Everyday Life, he appealed to the broad lay public with the idea of Freudian slips and other, you know, wonderful games to play. And from that point on, Freud never really did address his colleagues in psychology, much less psychiatry. When his reputation with the public reached this apogee in the 1950s, apparently people in medicine went along with it. I can't understand why they did, but we know that they did. And it wasn't until the 1970s. Actually, I take that back. In the 1950s, something important happened that eventually would cause the downfall of psychoanalysis, and that was the arrival of psychoactive drugs for psychoses. It's not a straightforward reputation of psychoanalysis by any means, but the fact that these drugs had so many immediate profound effects made psychiatrists begin to think that our explanatory paradigm of going into the infancy and the relationship with mommy and all that might be just off the point. And I think, you know, whatever we think of the efficacy of psychotropic drugs, historically speaking, that's been more important than the tradition of intellectual criticism that I was speaking about.
Two-parter. First of all, when you take morphine and cocaine together, it's called a speedball.
That's right.
Be useful for you. Other thing is that for those of us who teach psychology, I'm not a practicing psychologist, but I do teach as a psych professor. Students often ask, after I tell them some truth, and now I have more truth about Freud because of your book and your talk, they'll ask us, then why are we learning this? So do you have an answer for us?
Boy, I'm going down to Stanford and some weeks to talk to a group of that's studying, you know, great thinkers, and Freud is one of them, and I have the same problem myself. My answer, which is not a very strong one, is if you want to understand the 20th century, you've got to deal with Freud historically. But the idea that Freudian notions can actually help us to understand reality, I think, is just a non-starter. And the sooner this news gets to the intellectuals, the better. Because they are the last to notice.
Actually, we do have time for one more question.
Okay.
This is an interesting discussion. And why don't you extend this program a little longer and let people chat about this? My comment would be that of all the interviews that this man had and all the information that he gleaned, you're erasing because of his character flaws. And I'm a little bothered by that, because he had to have learned something. Taking all that data and processing all that data, you have to learn something from the data. If your presentation is fallible and your character is fallible, does not mean that parts of that information are constructive and useful.
I couldn't agree more. The problem is Freud didn't have much data. His rivals, almost every one of his rivals, was associated with a hospital and could draw on hundreds, maybe even thousands of patient cases in order to generalize from them. Freud had this one-man practice in his office with patients who, as I pointed out, left him in droves. At the very time that he was writing The Interpretation of Dreams, he had only two long-term patients, and one of them was Emma Eckstein. The fact is, and you can tell by reading The Interpretation of Dreams, 1900, very closely, the fact is that Freud faked acquaintance with a great number of patients, the data from whom was actually simply autobiographical. And he's really talking about himself. And sometimes he confuses other people with himself. Now, of course, we should never deny the validity of a theory based on the character of the person who proposed the theory. I object to psychoanalysis on two grounds. Freud claimed to have cured patients. He never cured one. And number two, he claimed to have discovered things. He never discovered anything. And if you don't believe it, just ask yourself, what is it? What is it? When and where did he discover what? Who observed it? If he cured patients, surely there must have been a patient somewhere who claimed that he or she was cured by Freud. There aren't any. So the whole thing was a fake. And really, what we're dealing with now is one of the most interesting people in the history of human thought. A guy who got away with claiming to have made world historical discoveries and humanitarian cures of tremendous value, and who simply lied about it. Just lied about it.
You know, you're describing our president.
Yeah. You're not the first person who said that.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Cruz. That was absolutely wonderful.
Okay,
thank
great.
And ladies and gentlemen, I do want to thank you for coming to this talk, and I hope you have a wonderful evening. Thank you.